The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles of Prince Lippy from the Harvard Heart Letter. This is the Harvard Heart Letter of June 2024. And the lead article is entitled, Interval Training, a Shorter, More Enjoyable Workout. As one of the most popular exercise trends for more than a decade, high-intensity interval training, or HIIT, clearly provides some perks. These workouts aren't just a time-efficient way to boost your fitness. Research shows that HIIT can improve key measures of cardiovascular health for all sorts of people, including those recovering from heart attacks or heart surgery. Another advantage is that high-intensity effort, even for just brief bursts, may trigger the release of mood-boosting brain chemicals. As its name implies, HIIT features high-intensity, vigorous activity done in intervals, with brief periods of either rest or lower intensity activity in between. During the bursts of vigorous exercise, your heart rate rises higher, and then it remains higher than it would normally be in between those high intensity bouts. Compared to 20 minutes of moderate intensity exercise, a 20-minute HIIT session will burn more calories, strengthen your heart more, and help your body use oxygen more efficiently. If your goal is to improve your fitness, doing moderate intensity exercise certainly works, but HIIT workouts may raise your fitness level faster in a shorter period of time, says Dr. Sawala Gusa, director of the Cardiovascular Performance Program at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. As he points out, if you do mostly vigorous exercise, you can meet the federal exercise guidelines in just 75 minutes per week, whereas doing mostly moderate exercise takes twice as long, 150 minutes per week. If long sessions of vigorous exercise feel too challenging, adding some HIIT workouts to your exercise regimen can be a happy medium. Even short stints of high-intensity exercise appear to trigger the release of endorphins, the brain's feel-good chemicals. In our clinic, we certainly see patients who say that HIIT workouts bring them the most joy. In addition, endorphins can counteract pain, which may mitigate some of the discomfort that can occur during HIIT workouts, so people perceive them as more pleasant than expected. The most important thing is to find a form of exercise that you enjoy and can do consistently over the long haul, Dr. Gusa says. Steady, moderate intensity exercise is also a great way to keep your cardiovascular system healthy. If you have heart disease or are at an increased risk for it, be sure to check with your doctor before adding high-intensity effort to your routine. People at increased risk include those with two or more of the following: diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or a family history of heart disease. Traditionally, HIIT features 30 to 90 seconds of high-intensity effort, followed by an equal or longer period of lower-intensity activity or rest. High-intensity is often defined as reaching 85% of your maximum heart rate. A simpler option is to aim for an 8 on your personal perceived exertion scale, where 1 is very easy and 10 is as hard as you can possibly go. When you're first starting out, alternate a few short intervals of high-intensity exercise with longer periods of moderate or easy exercise. Say you usually walk for 30 minutes. Start by walking for 5 minutes, then walk as fast as you can or jog for 1 minute. Go back to your usual pace or even a bit slower for 3 minutes. Repeat the fast walking, slow walking cycle 5 more times. Once you become more fit, you can spend more time walking faster or jogging, and less time ambling or resting. You can turn any cardio workout, cycling, swimming, elliptical, stationary bike, treadmill, stair climber, rowing machine, and even dancing, into an interval session. The easiest way is to simply speed up and slow down. Outdoors, add hills to running or a cycling route to create greater intensity. Indoors, you might want to add some stair climbing or jumping. For variety, try other HIIT variations. Harvard Health Publishing's report, Interval Training, features 5 sample workouts and can be looked at www.health.harvard.edu/INTR. The article goes on to mention 2 internationally inspired types of interval training. The first is the Swedish fartlek, F-A-R-T-L-E-K, which is a relaxed, fun way of doing intervals. You push yourself as long as you can based on how you're feeling, or until you reach a target like a tree, light pole, or house, or someone ahead of you. Then you recover for as long as you need. Your intervals don't have to be identical. When you feel ready, pick another target and go. While the intervals are informal, they can still be challenging. And then there's the Japanese interval training called Tabata, T-A-B-A-T-A. Named after the Japanese researcher who created it, Tabata workouts feature 20-second work intervals and 10-second recovery intervals that are done 8 times in a 4-minute series. Try it with any type of aerobic exercise like walking, running, or cycling. Tabata classes often include multiple rounds of different exercises like jumping jacks, knee pulls, or mountain climbers designed to work all the major muscle groups. Instructors combine different variations of the 4-minute series to create workouts that last a half an hour to an hour. The next section of the Harvard Heart Letter, again, this is the June 2024 issue, is a series of questions for Dr. Christopher Cannon, who's the editor-in-chief. And the question is, I've been taking a product called Niagen, nicotinamide riboside, as an anti-aging supplement. But I recently read that niacin may increase the risk of heart disease. Could that be a concern with Niagen as well? Niacin, or vitamin B3, is a water-soluble vitamin that helps your body convert food into energy. Niacin is the generic name for nicotinic acid and nicotinamide, also called niacinamide, and related derivatives like nicotinamide riboside, the product you take. Niacin occurs naturally in many foods like poultry, nuts, beans, and grains. It's also found in multivitamin supplements, B-complex supplements, and supplements containing only niacin. Nicotinic acid and nicotinamide are the 2 main forms found in supplements. High-dose nicotinic acid is also available as a prescription medication to improve blood lipid levels. Niacin can also lower triglycerides and raise HDL, usually requiring 1,500 to 2,000 milligrams a day to achieve this. Prescription niacin has not been shown to lower the risk of death, heart attack, or stroke. A large study of more than 25,000 patients tested niacin in combination with cholesterol-lowering statin drugs and found little additional benefit when compared with statins alone. What's more, high-dose niacin was associated with many worrisome side effects, including a higher risk of new-onset diabetes, worsening control of diabetes, and a higher risk of severe gastrointestinal symptoms requiring hospitalization. As a result, in 2016, the FDA withdrew its approval of niacin for use in combination with statins or other lipid-lowering agents. Since then, niacin use in people with heart disease has fallen. The recent news about niacin you're referring to comes from a study of 1,100 people with heart disease who were followed for 3 years. Researchers found that higher blood levels of two breakdown products of excess niacin were linked to an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. However, they had no information about the participants' dietary niacin intake, and because this wasn't a clinical trial, the results cannot prove that niacin is to blame. In addition, we know that the amount of niacin found in multiple vitamins is not harmful. According to the NIH Office of Dietary Supplements, the daily upper limit, the largest daily intake of a nutrient considered safe for most people, for niacin from dietary supplements is 35 milligrams for adults. Nicotinamide has fewer side effects than nicotinic acid, but at high doses, 500 milligrams per day or more, nicotinamide can cause diarrhea and easy bruising and can increase bleeding from wounds. So that's something to keep in mind when taking nicotinamide supplements. Also, based on the scientific evidence to date, the supplement appears to have little benefit for people. The next article from the Harvard Heart Letter of June 2024, when the heart suddenly starts racing. You expect your heartbeat to accelerate if you're exercising or feeling extremely anxious, but in a small number of people, an electrical glitch in the heart's upper chamber causes their heart rate to suddenly soar for no apparent reason, sometimes as high as 200 beats per minute. Called PSVT, or paroxysmal supraventricular tachycardia, the condition is usually not dangerous. People often describe the symptoms as palpitations or a fluttering sensation in the chest, says Dr. Paul Zei, that's Z-E-I, director of the Comprehensive Atrial Fibrillation Program at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. While these episodes typically appear out of the blue, exercise, stress, or certain foods and drugs, like caffeine or other stimulants, sometimes trigger an episode. For some people, bending over at the waist can set off PSVT, Dr. Z says. The frequency and duration of the episodes varies widely. Some people have a bout just once every few years, while others have them several times a day. The episode may last a few seconds or minutes. Others last for hours, or in rare cases, even days. These rapid-fire beats mean the ventricles don't have time to fill before the next heart contraction. As a result, blood flow to the brain and body may drop, causing symptoms of lightheadedness, breathlessness, and fainting. Fewer than about 3 in every 1,000 people have PSVT. It occurs in people of all ages, from babies to older adults, but half of all cases are in people aged 50 to 64. Women account for just over 2/3 of all cases. Because a fast heartbeat and breathlessness are also common symptoms of anxiety, primary care doctors may misdiagnose the problem as anxiety, especially in women, Dr. Z says. An accurate diagnosis requires an electrocardiogram, or ECG, a recording of the heart's electrical signature at the time symptoms occur. Because the episodes don't last long, the heartbeat has usually returned to normal by the time a person seeks medical attention. As a result, people with suspected PSVT usually need to wear a small EKG monitor on their chest for several days or weeks to confirm the diagnosis. Using a smartwatch or other device, that can record an ECG is another option. If a specialist examines the data, these readings can be quite accurate for diagnosing PSVT, says Dr. Z. People with bothersome symptoms can try a handful of simple tricks that stimulate the vagus nerve, which helps to slow the conduction of electrical impulses through the heart and may resolve the tachycardia. These simple tricks include coughing or gagging, putting an ice-cold wet towel on your face, pressing gently on your closed eyes, holding your breath while bearing down as if for a bowel movement. The most effective technique, the modified Valsalva maneuver, involves sitting upright while blowing into a straw or small tube for 15 seconds. Then, lie flat on your back and raise your legs to a 45-degree angle with another person supporting your legs for 15 seconds. If these methods don't work, people with persistent tachycardia usually need to go to an urgent care or emergency room to receive an injection or infusion of medication to return the heart to a normal rate. A nasal spray containing the experimental drug etripamil for treating PSVT is currently under FDA review. People with frequent bothersome symptoms may want to consider catheter ablation, a short procedure done under mild sedation. After a doctor threads a catheter through a vein up to the heart, a zap of radio frequency energy emitted from a device inside the catheter destroys a small area of tissue, causing the errant electrical signal. For PSVT, catheter ablation is 98% successful and is quite safe. It's one of the few cardiac procedures for which we can almost always tell patients they've been cured and the problem won't ever occur again. As with any procedure, make sure you understand all the pros and cons beforehand. Another interesting article from the Harvard Heart Letter of June 2024 is entitled Migraine and Cardiovascular Disease, What's the Link? What do cardiovascular disease and migraines have in common? For one, both conditions involve changes in blood vessel, blood flow, and inflammation. Another link, migraine sufferers younger than 45 who experience odd visual or physical sensations prior to headache may face an increased risk of stroke. Finally, the most common and effective class of drugs to treat migraine, the triptans, T-R-I-P-T-A-N-S, have been linked to a higher risk of stroke and heart attack in people at risk for those cardiovascular conditions. But if you're among the 1 in 6 people who copes with these debilitating, painful headaches, there's reassuring news. Both of those risks are extremely small. The article goes on to say, during a migraine, blood vessels lining the brain dilate in response to abnormal activity in cells in the cerebral cortex, the largest area of the brain. This triggers a cascade of inflammation and other processes that can spread throughout the brain, says Dr. Natalie Roost, professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and chief of the stroke division at Massachusetts General Hospital. It's why migraines can cause a wide range of symptoms, including nausea, fatigue, or sensitivity to light. People tend to experience their own particular combination of symptoms that progress gradually during the migraine, often in a predictable pattern. In contrast, the symptoms of a stroke appear suddenly. If you feel numb or weak on one side of your face or body, are unable to speak normally, or lose vision, that's a 911 situation, says Dr. Roost. In people who get migraines, those same symptoms might be related to an aura, but play it safe and seek medical attention right away, she advises. Migraines are about three times as common in women as men, for reasons that aren't entirely clear. Up to 30% of women aged 20 to 40 get migraines, but strokes are very rare among young women. Even if their risk of stroke doubles, as one study of people who have migraine with aura found, the overall prevalence is still very low. Still, women who have migraine with aura should be sure to tell their primary care provider or gynecologist about their headache. Taking estrogen-containing birth control pills or hormone therapy may further raise stroke risk in these women. As a result, they might want to consider non-hormonal or estrogen-free treatment options. Last year, a study based on real-world data from patients ranked the class of drug known as triptans as the most helpful treatment for quelling their migraine symptoms. But these drugs, which include elotriptan or Relpax and zolmitriptan or Zomig, aren't recommended for people with cardiovascular disease, based on evidence that these drugs may raise the risk of stroke and heart attack. Earlier this year, findings from a study of 400,000 people who received a triptan prescription confirmed that observation. However, the absolute risk of cardiovascular problems is extremely low, about 1 in 30,000. Most of the stroke and heart attacks occur in people with risk factors for heart disease, like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes. What struck me was how rare these events were among this huge population, says Dr. Rost. Still, she recommends a personalized approach when selecting medications for migraine sufferers who have or are at risk for cardiovascular problems. Newer migraine drugs, known as calcitonin gene-related peptide, CGRP, inhibitors, don't appear to have any significant side effects related to blood vessels, but the long-term effects are still unknown. CGRP inhibitors approved for acute migraine include oral rimegepant, or Nurtec, and ubrogepant, or Ubrelvy, as well as nasal zavirgepant, or Zavzpret. Now here's a section called Research We're Watching, again from the Harvard Heart Letter. The first short article says, many older adults still follow outdated aspirin advice. A nationwide poll suggests that 1 in 4 older adults takes an aspirin regularly in hopes of preventing heart attack or stroke, even though updated guidelines from 2019 advise against this practice. Aspirin helps to prevent blood clots that can cause a heart attack or stroke, but the drug can also cause serious bleeding in the gastrointestinal tract and brain. Thanks to a better appreciation of that risk, daily low-dose aspirin is now recommended mainly for people who've already had a heart attack or face a very high risk of one. But 57% of adults who said they take aspirin regularly also said they had no history of cardiovascular disease, and nearly one-third of these people don't appear to know about aspirin's bleeding risk. People who do not have heart disease should talk to their doctor before starting, continuing, or stopping daily aspirin use. The March 2024 poll from the University of Michigan National Poll on Healthy Aging surveyed a national sample of 2,657 adults aged 50 to 80. The next short article, concerns about the health effects of microplastics continue to mount. That's MICROPLASTICS. Now a new study finds that people with microplastics in the plaque clogging their neck arteries were far more likely to have a heart attack or stroke than people with plastic-free plaque. When researchers tested the plaque removed from the neck arteries of 257 people, they found tiny particles of plastic, mostly polyethylene, but also polyvinyl chloride, in 58% of the people. After nearly 3 years, the rate of heart attack, stroke, and death was 4.5 times higher in people with microplastics in their plaque than those without. These observational findings can't pinpoint microplastics as the culprit, as other unmeasured exposures or habits may be to blame, says the authors, whose study was published in the March 7th, 2024 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. Used to make plastic bags and bottles, polyethylene slowly breaks down and is found in food and water, which may explain how microplastics enter the body. Finally, hot weather has been tied to increased odds of stroke. High temperatures may leave people more vulnerable to stroke, according to a study in JAMA Network Open. The study was done on 82,000 people across China who were hospitalized for an ischemic stroke during the warm seasons. By checking hourly temperature records for up to 24 hours before a person's stroke symptoms began, researchers found that as temperatures rose, so did the risk of stroke. The risk was twice as high when temperatures were around 92 degrees Fahrenheit compared to when the temperature was 54 degrees. The risk was highest immediately after a person was exposed to high temperatures and lasted for 10 hours. High temperatures may trigger dehydration, which can make the blood more viscous and more likely to clot. People at increased risk of stroke should exercise with caution, reduce outdoor activities, and use air conditioning to protect themselves from high temperatures, say the study authors. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.